Okay, I think we're ready to begin, and Professor Gold has to leave in about 10 minutes, so I told him we would let him open and take a couple of questions and then proceed. And let me just quickly introduce all of the gentlemen up here. Professor Thomas Gold to my left of Cornell, Dr. Jeffrey Eglinton of the University of Bristol, England, Dr. Stuart O. Agrell of the University of Cambridge, England, Dr. Robin Brett of the Manned Spacecraft Center, and Dr. Michael Moret. I'm sorry, Dr. Mazursky, I didn't see you there. Dr. Harold Mazursky, sitting next to Dr. Robin Brett. Dr. Mazursky is of the U.S. Geological Survey and Flagstaff. And on the end is Dr. Michael Moret, the Laboratory of Spectrometry is the anglicized version of that. Thank you. Dr. Gold?
Well, I'm afraid I won't be here later to defend myself because I have to go in a few minutes. So I just want to say, I mean, that I stress the point of view that we have not got any definite evidence yet of the very large-scale lava flows which everyone assumes to have filled the Mare basins. I see the same as everybody else that, you know, it would be nice to think that there was a liquid that had filled them because they're so flat, but on the other hand, there are just as grave or even graver a set of problems if you think that huge lava flows like that have taken place on the moon as there are in supposing that material in some other form, a solid, has gotten in to fill the Mare. And I personally believe that it is possible that the combination of meteoritic bombardment and electrostatic forces on the surface in the vacuum of the moon will produce large-scale transportation on this very long time scale of the moon, and perhaps in the more violent circumstances in earlier days, because we don't need to have the mean rate of transportation do it now. It can have done it very much more in earlier days than it's doing now. The kind of rates involved, 10,000, the average would have to have been a filling rate of 1 centimeter in 10,000 years, and that's not all that much. So it's very slow compared with any terrestrial transportation processes. The seismic evidence that we have, I believe to be totally incompatible with a solid rock at a shallow depth. And nothing that I've heard will dissuade me from that statement. There is no even an approximation to a solid sheet of rock underfoot between the impact and seismograph sites. The only way in which I can understand the signal is by supposing that there's a very low velocity of sound, and that the only substance that has that would be a powder of gradually increasing speed of sound, and that would be possessed by gradually compacting powder with depth, and that is the regime down to at least 4 kilometers. I've done calculations of sample tracings of acoustic rays, and if I place the solid rock any shallower than 4 kilometers, then the signal that would be received looks obviously noticeably different from those that were received. While if I make it a depth of more than 4 kilometers of gradually increasing speed of sound, then I can reproduce the type of signals that are seen in the seismographs perfectly well. So I feel persuaded that there is no chance that there's a solid sheet of rock at less than 4 kilometers depth in those sites.
Questions? Yes, let's take the questions and then we'll proceed on. Do we have any questions? Okay.
I think we have the direct evidence for the occurrence of the basalt sheets that many have postulated from examining the petrology by looking at the pictures, both of the top surface of flows and the edges of them. And on Apollo 15, we'll look at the Hadley Rail, where we think we see for several miles a basalt ledge exposed.
And we see basalt ledge. You see some kind of a stratum.
See a ledge.
Be careful.
Yes, we see a ledge.
You see some kind of a stratum.
Yes.
In one place, you see an awful lot of area of steep slopes, including inside the Hadley Ridge, where you see nothing.
This is just because they're covered in scree anyway.
Yes. Yeah. I wanted to suggest a test for this.
Pick up lumps of basalt, but I mean, where they have come from, we don't know. And whether they are from
lower than 4 meters.
Huh?
They came from lower than 4 meters.
Yes, and I say they came from 4 kilometers.
Sorry, I can't help you.
Well,
Tommy, you have to help me. They came from 4 kilometers, you say, but they had to do this in a relatively recent time scale. So you must demand big impacts to penetrate to 4 kilometers depth in a time scale of the past 10 million years. Now, then you have to put that little fly in the soup and see if it swims. And that was my question, which I unfortunately directed to someone else, but it seemed you missed that minor point.
No, I believe that big impacts dug down the solidified rock, the crystalline rock, at a fairly early epoch, and that the whole Mare material is sprinkled throughout its interior, mainly composed of fines, but sprinkled throughout it in a statistical equilibrium situation with chunks that were dug up at various times, some of which at any one period are on the surface. That's what I believe. And I believe that that's a very strong case for that, because I see wrinkled ridges on the Maria which have a great concentration of blocks on the top, and no one has been able to produce me any other way of having a concentration of blocks on the on the top of a ridge except by supposing that this was internal blocks when the ridge was lifted up, and that a lot of fines have eroded away, leaving a concentration of the large chunks that did not erode away. That's been the only process known to anybody for making this, and that means that that material, when it was lifted up to be a wrinkled ridge, contained in bulk and in depth a lot of chunks.
Is there anything in the next 4 Apollo flights that will either convince you to change your mind or to stick with your theory?
No.
Is there some kind of experiment that's going to resolve
anybody,
it?
If those lava sheets are there at a depth of 6 feet, as all these people say, then of course it would be exceedingly likely that we would land on a place where there's a great big outcrop of it, because to wipe away 6 feet of stuff in some location by a nearby impact would be dead easy. So of course there would be a very strong chance, if that lava sheet were there, that we would see it with a vengeance. But so far we have not seen it anywhere, nor on the orbiter pictures.
Well, we're invoking a mechanism for transporting material downhill, and since we're down in the Mare Basin and we do see fragments, and I think this is one of the most interesting things that's come out of the 2 rock conferences, by looking at the fine-grained material, you can look at a lot of things that have come from great distances. And the question is, do you transport them by this mechanism, or is it ballistically by the impact process? Now, if in fact we go into the uplands and find the material has been thrown into the uplands in large quantities ballistically, it can't get up there by electrostatic transport uphill. But my assumption is that Tommy would then say there are gravitational waves which wash it uphill.
Let me interrupt here for just a moment, if I could, to introduce the 2 latest arrivals. And then I think we seem to have a pretty good dialogue going, so rather than follow some rigid formula, what I'd like to do is leave it open. We'll continue to take questions, and if any of you gentlemen on the panel have an observation you'd like to make, we'll take it that way, rather than going right down the list with your observations. Down on the end of the table is Dr. Noel Hinners of Bellcom, and to my immediate left is Dr. Gerald Wasserberg of the California Institute of Technology. And let's continue on.
Can I interject something in there?
Certainly.
In the fairness I can bring up out of my heart for Tommy, there is a point that he's got, and the seismic people. And I keep coming back to this, and people seem to keep forgetting it, that these Mare basins started off with nothing in them at some depth, and they built up by a sequence, as far as we can tell, of flow units. The cratering rate was fantastically higher when those first flow units came out. We see evidence between the Apollo 11 and 12 for a difference of almost an order of magnitude in meteorite influx rate. So when these first flows came out, the rate may have been as much as 100, 200 times higher. And thin sheets, several meters thick of flow units, each one is progressively going to get beat and smashed, and if not thoroughly turned into regolith, at least broken into large chunks. So that I can easily envision that you can build up several hundred meters or even kilometers of interlayered regolith, debris, broken lava flow, and that it's only the topmost flows in the Mare that maintain their coherence over large distances, because they're the last ones when the flux was low. So the seismic people don't see a great density change in the upper kilometers. Doesn't bother me at all. The fact that rills cut down several hundred meters to me says, yeah, they're going through something reasonably uncohesive, which to me is old regolith layers interlayered with flow units, but they're still chunky and blocky. So I think the seismic stuff can be explained by a reasonable and plausible geologic model.
I know I'm asking a great deal here because any answer, if there is one, is going to be greatly oversimplified, but would anyone care to say at this point we think the moon formed very roughly in this way, went through very roughly this history, and now the composition is very generally this?
Yeah, clearly.
Surely there's a consensus. I think that there's a confusion in the details if one does not see the consensus, and then the Russian data today just doubles it in spades. Now, if you want nitty-gritty details, there isn't, but there are certain broad parts of the picture that are eminently clear now, and I thought that they were presented several times by many people. I mean, they were presented by many of us. I think the answer is yes, there is a broad consensus. I think there's a confusion if one talks about silly things like the Ringwood model of the moon or theory, but there are certainly some straight observational facts which are very obvious. Namely, the moon partly melted, and it partly melted for about 1.5 billion years after it was formed. And it was highly fractionated from the average material of our solar system, as was again stated innumerable times. And there are a whole bunch of things which could be stated along this line, which... Yeah. The only thing is that this all been said so many times, it's almost a little bit of an embarrassment to repeat it. And it's like giving a speech 20 times, you sort of get, you know, P&V drops down.
Well, we'd like it to synopsis at this point.
Jesus, got one, I thought, today. I'd rather pass in it. But I think that there is a clear-cut thing. If you look at the Russian mission and the results, which we can only evaluate in a very tentative fashion, one sees, boy, what a third-order pun, that the lunar seas have a certain universal characteristic. They are, Apollo 11 site showed this typical enhancement, which was compared to the rocks. It was found on 12, and the Russians have found this on their other site. The seas are, against my prejudices, which are opposed to, for example, a gentleman sitting far down to my left, really are a lot of basalts there. And they're all over. And they're chemically very similar, and they show a great degree of fractionation from two things. Certainly the material that the solar system is made of as a whole, and secondly, a great deal of fractionation compared to what the moon is made of as a whole. So the moon is, to some extent, a layered planet. And now the question is, how thick is this layer which has been separated out? Is this layering a primary structure during the accretionary process of the moon, which was subsequently melted on the outside, or is it the result of a broader planetary turnover? We don't know yet, but we shall find out. We know very clearly and obviously that the formation of granitic-type components, rocks rich in the elements which can melt planets, uranium and potassium, and the associated elements therewith are abundantly present on the moon and sprinkled about all over so that they dominate the soil in certain characteristics. And that these things mean that crustal evolution in planets proceeded on an exceedingly rapid time scale, and that separation from the sun of the planets proceeded on a time scale which was almost simultaneous. And I think that's not details, but... that's the story about the way it was.
I'm delighted to hear you say these kinds of words.
Yeah, you stole me owe me a bottle of whiskey, which I wrote you a letter about, when your false crater counting estimates. Now, this is a very good time, because I truly have public witness that the false crater counts estimates from the flux rates of the ages of the Mare basins have been proven to be very ancient. And I would now like to publicly demand after writing your letter my bottle of good whiskey.
Well, I have to amend this because their shoemakers count.
Yeah, but you made them. The bet. That shows that you were not so smart.
No, I think this is an important question, and I'm sorry that Vinogradov couldn't give us a number, because somebody asked him a very critical question, and that is, what's the crystallization age of your rock from Fecunditatis? Because we now have two points, and those are quite different, and Fecunditatis should have been different yet, and we're hoping that this span of igneous activity, and I guess the geologist's pitch has been that the moon has an evolutionary history of itself. It's evolved a crust, and that crust is highly silicic, and we hope we'll get samples of it in the next mission. And then the Mare basins are later, and they didn't have it at one catastrophic event. It has evolved like the Earth has, and each basin has its own history. So the ages of each of these basins should be different, and we had a lovely chance for the Russians to give us one of those ages. Now, he said their samples are too small, but I'll bet some of our people could take one of those little pieces and get a crystallization date.
You might just bet that now.
Yes. The little piece.
Everly?
I'm interested to know, have any of you all heard anything here this week that changed any of your ideas, or was there enough really presented to sort of support what you had come here with?
I mean, does anyone ever change their mind about anything?
So I'm asking a very specific question. I want to know if each one of you heard anything that you felt the data was good, valid data. Well, I know you heard good, but I mean something that you felt like you could no longer believe in that you had believed before. You know what I'm asking.
I'll say it. Yes, of course. Well, for one thing, I mentioned out there that there are several different types of scientists, which is very obvious. And one philosophical point that in NASA, in starting this whole Apollo program, to me it seems rather like taking a Noah's Ark and not putting two in, you know, two at a time, but several here and a few here and so on, and seeing what happens. In some cases, I think they've mated. In some cases, they've killed each other off. But the in this conference here, in this conference here, there certainly has been a mating in certain areas, and the area that comes to mind in our case is the mating between the rare gases and the organics, which is rather unexpected, perhaps, by some people. And it certainly changed my ideas, because I find some people using techniques which we thought we were good at, and they've got a factor of three a thousand times sensitivity benefit, but they don't have the chemistry that goes with it in this particular case.
Is it horses and zebras? Will the product be sterile?
No, I don't think so. I think the product is going to be really rather powerful when it gets going.
You can perhaps ask another question. You can perhaps ask the following question. Do you have new data which are difficult to interpret, actually, and that you hope to interpret next year, for example, after 1 year of work? Okay? Yeah. And in the field of the irradiation history of the lunar samples, we have definitely very new data. And this new data, for example, is the exotic particle track of Price. I don't know if some of you have seen this very long track in a lunar crystal, okay? Other results have been reported by the Bombay group, the group of Lal. We are not sure at all that they are right, but it's perhaps an evidence for extant isotope, and this work has to be confirmed. And we have really observed, definitively, we have this data, we have very high track density in the finest dust grain, and we have to interpret that. We have to go back in the laboratory, because it could mean either that these finest dust grains are cosmic dust particles accreted by the moon, or that they have, or that these grains have been rock degradation product exposed on the moon to a new flux of solar particle, which is just beginning to be studied in space. And I think that really in 1 year from now, we will have changed our idea about the irradiation history of the lunar sample. And you have also to realize that with the surveyor glass, with the surveyor 3 glass track work which has been done, we will better understand the track study in the rock, in the lunar rock now. And I cannot predict very well what will happen in 1 year from now.
Anyone else? Dr. Mazursky?
I think there are three very exciting things that have come out of the kinds of data. The one is the enormously laborious studies that people have done with finds, and the fact that this allows you to look at a lot of moon from any one spot. And it confirms a lot of things that people said, but it's a reality, and it gives us the chance of studying samples, and we can talk about highland composition even though we've not been there. That's, I think, a very nice effort. I think the paleomagnetic data was enormously exciting because that tells you something about the history, and that's what geologists are interested in. This says that the moon had to be very different in the past, you know, high magnetic things in the past and low now. So now we have a sort of a time base to construct our ideas on what's evolved. And then the third thing are the direct age measurements that people like Wasserberg have done, and these, I think, are an intensely exciting thing. It pushed the whole history back much farther than many people had thought from crater counts. And I won't go into that long, sad story. But that's the other area that, and to me, the exciting thing is the fact that the differences are small, and geologically we'd expect those differences to be small in the areas that we landed in. This gives us the incentive to go to areas that we hope will be greatly different in age. We have a little time base, and we hope we can get a lot much more.
Yes, I mean, the situation with each of these manned explorations, we are standing on a small area, looking at material from the regolith, which can have come from a long distance, is just like that of, Antarctic explorers at the beginning of the last century. They landed from their sailing ships on the shore, and they picked up pebbles on the beach or the end of a glacier, and they looked at this stuff and they said, "Ah, yes, now hidden under this ice sheet, there are all this different kind of rocks, or they're exposed in the mountain way up behind." And here we have exactly the same situation on the moon. Among this fragments that we pick up, which have been transported by meteoritic explosions and other types of agency, then we're gradually extending our field of the kinds of things that occur on the moon, and that photogeologists have some idea of the distribution of what things are, but until or the kinds of units that might exist, but until they can get a sample from a particular unit, they can't label it. They've called it X or something like that, instead of calling it a porphyritic basalt or an orthosite or something like that. And at this, in this particular thing, in a new rock type, so to speak, was discovered and was particularly widespread in the regolith, and may be characteristic of one of these formations which photogeologists, like you people of Flagstaff, have recognized on the moon. But this is still speculation. It comes from somewhere. It must have a characteristic topographic form, but we just don't know. At the moment, we speculate as to which part of the moon it came from. There's so much of it that it can't have come from far.
Let's catch a question here and then proceed on.
To speculate a little further along the line of the Antarctic analogy, if you were to put yourself in the position of the modern-day Antarctic explorer who finds the fossil near the South Pole, what would be the analogy as far as the moon is concerned? What would be the real ringer that would tie the continental drift theory of the moon together?
Well, there are several ringers. I mean, there's one, the obvious one, that one feels intuitively that the Terai, the highland regions of the rock, are a suite of things which are closely genetically related together, and one would like to go there and see what they are. The other material which one would like to do to see would be material which you could establish that had come from at some considerable depth in the moon, because if as you could do, as you can do on the Earth, you can go to the Kimberley diamond pipes and you can get an ectergite block tossed up. This tells you actually what the mineral assemblage was at some considerable depth. And it is these foreign exotic fragments. If you could have a volcano on the moon, which you might have in the rills, I gather, because there are strings of pipes that run along them, then these might toss up something from below which would enable your speculation, instead of making artificial models, reconstructing them, telling, in effect, what my grandfather is like by looking at me and saying I've got a big nose and my grandfather's a big nose, but forgetting it's a genetic recessive or something like that. Instead of reconstructing the ancestor from something which is quite a long way down the line, as these late evolved basalts are, you will have the ancestor or his direct descendant in your hand.
And this is very last year's site selection meetings.
This is a most important thing. This, by analogy with what has happened on the Earth, is true, isn't it, that geophysicists had every idea, so many ideas about what the inside of the Earth was like, or the mantle was like. There were innumerable models, which have gradually become simpler by the fact that, okay, one has actually examined on the Earth some mantle material.
To extend Stuart's statement there, I think the historical way we found CREEP at MSC was, first of all, seeing the glass, seeing it was unusual, and then the next big question, well, what's CREEP's father? He must, presumably there is a parent somewhere. Are we seeing that in the sample that we've got? Then we identified CREEP's father. Then the question after that, which hasn't been solved, does CREEP have a grandfather, or does he have a second cousin or a cousin, trying to relate the whole thing? Then I think the adverse of the question you're asking, Everly, namely what things we disagreed on, I think the exciting thing here was that everybody saw that CREEP was an important thing. CREEP, the granitic component, granitic type component, quintessence, whatever you like. Everybody saw this was important, reported about it, and everybody also came to the conclusion that we were dealing with some type of material which is different to Mare basalt and comes from presumably some sort of highland, using it highland in its broadest term. Two groups came up with fairly strongly, but leaving themselves open for a Copernican origin. Another group came up with either the Fra Mauro formation, which is the nearest place 18 kilometers away from the site, or Reinholdt or Landsberg. This is really a second order thing, because all of those three places, Landsberg, Reinholdt, and Copernicus, are craters punched into Fra Mauro formation, so it really doesn't matter an enormous amount. It's a second-order thing, where this came from. Then a final thing to elaborate on what Stuart Agrell was saying, are we looking at material from depth? If this material is some type of Fra Mauro formation, this means that probably it's Imbrian ejecta. Now, in the Imbrian crater, the Imbrian basin was carved out quite a depth, and we don't know what depth we're sampling. Intuitively, from this, the composition of this stuff, people have been saying lunar crust. You don't know how deep that crust is, but you can say, I think, that this creep component probably comes from greater depth than the Mare basalt which we've been sampling previously.
Do we have any other observations on the panel before we return to questions?
I like to point out that you have to try to broaden your point of view by realizing really that the study of the lunar samples begins to help us to understand other things in the solar system. For example, we can measure the albedo of the moon with a telescope, and we can measure the albedo of this powder in the laboratory, and we can understand the microscopic feature which are related to the albedo of the sample. And then we are looking with a telescope on the asteroid, for example, which are far away from us. We can measure the albedo of this asteroid too, and if we understand the relationship between the albedo and the microscopic history of the sample, we will get a better understanding of the history of the asteroid. And I think that we are actually developing also criteria to identify perhaps cosmic dust in Antarctica, you see. And it's the study of the lunar sample, it's only the study of the lunar samples which will allow us to make big progress in that kind of field. And I don't know if the other member can comment on that.
No, I think that's probably, if you look at space exploration from a sort of a backed off point of view, and one wants to think about deep space exploration, which anybody with a scientific inclination must look forward to for the future of mankind, if we don't blow ourselves up or something stupid, is that the moon is not only its keystone. If we were going to do deep exploration of, say, orbiters for Mars to try to find out something about the structure of Mars, then clearly we must understand something about the similar experiences and experiments on the moon, where we can use some control over remote sensing devices with materials which we bring back. Now, we've had cock and bull theories in this business that would fill this room up in microfiche form. And the real important thing is that now we have a means of both testing the hypotheses, of testing remote sensing devices, which are terribly, terribly tricky. Everybody has a fear of them because of the fact that, you know, you can't play with it. And you can look at these things. You can take and compare our experience with, for example, orbiting gamma ray and X-ray spectrometry. And if that should really prove to be a successful thing, and with our comparison with return materials, we're just going to know a heck of a lot of things. And the albedo problem that was pointed out is certainly, when the arguments always were, is it a trivial thing we're looking at albedo differences, or is it profound? And I think we're learning it's profound. That's damned important. That means you're looking at a thin skin, a few angstroms thick, totally, with light, and it's telling you really something for real, and it's not fake. That's good for starters.
Dr. Agnew?
Cock and bull look like a microfiche.
Small.
I think Jerry said something of what I was going to say, but I'd like to take the philosophy a little bit further. And it seems to me, coming into this business over a number of years, that the effect of this whole Apollo business and the concrete arrival of the sample has had the effect very similar to the effect of a wartime effort, as for example happened in the UK and over here in the time of World War II, that it causes a catalytic, a time-dependent effort which is quite remarkable in the effect. And I think this effect is only now really beginning to show. A number of areas will drop out where the catalytic effect isn't very prominent. But in some areas, it's become extremely dramatic. And I would think that this is something that, if only we can maintain it, and of course further missions will do that, and beyond that time, of course, exploration of other objects in the solar system are going to have the same sudden surge into the scientific community.
Okay, let's take a couple of questions, John. And
Sherry. Do I understand what you gentlemen are saying you found an integrating factor at work here finally, after like last year everybody came in with his own bag of facts, but in the past year you've begun to integrate them and you've come together again and reintegrated, and now you're going out of here with a pretty well defined body of knowledge which allows you to proceed in certain new directions. Is that a fair assessment?
I think maybe answer your question and comment further on the past two things. I think to me the most exciting thing is the validation of the approach. That is that we have various scientific disciplines that have tried to look at information, and in the past it's had to be so hypothetical that any suggestion couldn't really be disproved. So they were all laid out, and you had, you know, 72 different ones. Well, now that we have a chance to bring back the samples, we can validate those conclusions that are made from remote instruments. And this says that we'll go to Mars and Mercury and Venus and the outer planets, and we can apply these techniques a little more securely. A very pedestrian example is that for the first 7 years that we made lunar maps, we called things materials. You know, we tried to call them rocks, but people said, you know, there are no rocks on the moon. You don't know that they're rocks. They're materials. And it was just an intense relief when surveyor when surveyor finally hit something, you know, and it broke it. It stuck together.
I'm worrying about the naming of what the rock is or something. I think the profound thing is the mechanism of evolution of a planet. I don't really care which formation it came from. I think that there has been and really was for a while a real confusion as to whether or not the real problem was to understand the stratigraphy of the moon or the problem to understand the development of the solar system. And that's the problem. And the validation that of rocks there is a trivial issue. Trying to find out that they really were telling us something about, you know, how the whole show was running, that's the big deal.
I agree that it's the big deal. But the trouble with some of us, we can only deal with trivia. And we have to do the best we can, and I hope you imaginative fellows can do more with it.
I can remember you, Jerry, when the geologists were coming in and trying to describe those rocks, and you were saying, for Christ's sake, is it a plagioclase or is it not? Or something.
Well, like, yeah. I'm a big trivia man myself, and I didn't mean to. As my colleagues and students will tell you, not to mention my enemies, which are frequently indistinguishable from my colleagues. But the point is, I think stating that there were rocks there, Hal, was a little bit, you know, we knew there were rocks in the moon. The question is, what were they going to tell us? And that was the big deal.
I think another important thing, too, is, and I think I pointed this out after the preliminary examination of 12, you might say this could be wishful thinking or at the moment, it's great that it's very good that the Apollo 12 rocks were different but still similar enough to the 11 rocks that you had a yardstick on which to base your work on 12. If they'd been totally different, we might have been floundering now, disconnected, not getting the whole thing put together into a picture until sometime later when we came and got something which lay halfway in between the two end members. So we have progressed, I think, from one type to another type which is different, and at the same time have had a component added in significant amounts which we can work on as well. And I think the third thing that is of importance there, finally the Russian analyses of all types that have come out again confirm the fact that Mare material is fairly similar wherever you go on the moon, in this case only three places, but I think you can now begin to generalize and say, well, we think the Mare were this way and then we think they were formed this way. If they were very, very different, it'd be much harder.
I'd like to return to Professor Eglinton's comment, which I think is perhaps one of the most profound comments made at this table. If you look at the termination of World War II and the output when declassification took place of the problems of nuclear energy and the technology, and I remember my student days and my post-student days when I was young, that I kept thinking as we hear all these papers, all the documents which were produced, I reminded myself of what Jeff just said, namely that at the termination of the bomb business, when most of the academics got out of it, there was a literature produced which was not just a pile of paper. It was a new science and a new technology. The whole scientific world moved to a totally new level. And I think that Jeff's point also about the organic PIs working in conjunction now with the rare gas people and the voluminous amounts of data which will come out, we'll see a technological step by cross-disciplinary fertilization which will produce in the next generation just a new kind of science.
I'd like to make an additional comment. Now that Jerry has admitted that he understands the concept of a rock, maybe I can go on to slightly more complicated ideas. That is, that not only are there rocks, but there look like there are volcanic rocks, and these imply certain things that happen fundamentally inside the planet. Then there are things that look like impact craters, and there's a balance of these two things going on. And to everyone's enormous surprise, when we got the first pictures from Mars, it looked quite a bit like the moon, now that we've gotten some better pictures, it looks as though the same kinds of things are going on there, that there are internal processes and bombardment from outside. So, and we find both of those things terrestrially. So we have a, let's say, a common base to try to look at the formation of various bodies in the solar system, and hopefully the balance between those two kinds of things, that is, the internal versus the external, will vary, and we'll have quite different stories to tell about each of the planetary bodies. That seems to me like an enormously exciting thing to look forward to working out.
I'd like to pause for a moment at this time, if we could, to let anybody who needs to leave, and then I think we can continue on for a few more minutes here.
Everyone. Could you clarify what you were arguing with Dr. Gold about before he left, about at what level this stuff comes from?
I always would argue with Dr. Gold. Dr. Gold told me before I gave his speech, he gave his speech, that he asked me if I had a tranquilizer. I told him that, in fact, I did have one, and I was about to proffer it him, and he said, I meant for you to take it. I am somewhat inured to his speeches now, since he says, he pushes gold dust pretty heavy. And as one of the speakers said, and changes it slightly all the time to fit. But the thing that was pointed out, I think, at this conference very clearly, that we can make firm statements that rocks now sit on the surface of the moon, or were there until some guys got up there and picked them up and lugged them back, that came from a depth beneath the surface of at least 4 meters, which is roughly 4 yards, and then something hit them and knocked them out about, say, 20 million years ago, or 100 million years ago, to be more precise. So the point was that an explanation such as he proposed had to be compatible with a mechanism which punched a hole through dirt and knocked up rocks. And what the, as he went out the door to his next liaison, the next point that was, of course, had to be discussed is the fact that he said it was a sort of a random mixture of rocks which are being tumbled back out. But in point of fact, it is not a random mixture of rocks, and therefore there you have to be expecting a real massive rock unit below. And unfortunately, he left before this great truth was announced to him.
How do you explain some of the surface phenomena that seems to be explained more easily by his moving around of the surface than other ways? I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding things, but for instance, the flux and the fact that the rocks are not covered with the dust, etc.
I'd like to give Jerry a break. Thanks, Jerry. Material is moving on the surface. It moves down slope. We've seen two pieces of evidence for that. First, these fillets, which on slopes are preferentially located on the upslope side. And second, some of the so-called tree bark structure, which appears to be the material moving down slope. A material must be moving even on the relatively flat areas. I think Tommy has a point that the grooves and things are eventually wiped out. We know they occur. You see boulder tracks down slopes, and something happens because some boulders you don't see them, and eventually they must fill in, both by the micrometeoroid bombardment effect of moving stuff around slowly but surely, and the downslope creep. And the other one, which has been mentioned, that's not the same kind of creep.
It's more realistic.
The other one, which you may remember in one of the sessions, people pointed out these lineations or grooves in the lunar surface. And some are so uniform and so closely spaced that there's no sensible explanation for them right now to come up with. But some of the possibilities are sort of a sympathetic shaking, seismic-induced shaking possibly, that will move material around. So there are all sorts of mechanisms for moving material around, even on the relatively flat areas. And I think the evidence is clear. Material does move around and fill in shallow little troughs and things.
Actually happens to this material on the surface when it goes through the Earth's magnetic tail, for instance? Do we know really the effect of the Earth's magnetic tail on something like this?
At the level Tommy was talking about, no, I don't. Let me say that. Maybe somebody else here does.
Yeah. I'd like to add something on that, too. A great deal of the soil is shocked to some degree or another. We know that shocked, yeah, you can see little striations and so on and melting and so on in the fine material. We know that one way of causing shock is by meteorite impact. This throws out material long distances. Therefore, since most of this material is shocked, why is it necessary to explain the majority of the movement of the lunar soil by some other mechanism? Number two, there have been two papers on relating the different rocks to the craters from which they came, two papers yesterday morning. If these rocks didn't come from those craters, and if this observation is correct, well, then they must, this inferred relation, if they came out of some deep crater off in the distance, must be a trick of God just to fool us. There's no other way to explain it.
I'd like to just say something about what Tommy says and so forth, and it's sort of a funny thing they say, particularly for me. Somehow, in the way, Tommy sort of keeps us honest, or at least intellectually alive in a lot of these problems. Really, whatever was said here, I think we actually do not understand the detailed mechanisms and processes acting for erosion and transport on the planetary surfaces for those planets which do not have an atmosphere. And we must keep our minds open and our imaginations really functioning to attempt to understand what these processes are, as, for example, Dr. Moret's distinguished contribution at this meeting of a super-thin erosion process. And these are the things which not simply pertain to the moon, but every planet and every Galilean satellite and everything without an atmosphere has suffered these processes, and we don't know much about them.
Dr. Yates isn't here, but could somebody briefly, very briefly, say what the evidence is for and against this core for the moon? There was a brief discussion this afternoon about it in the summary.
The only one
I'm personally familiar with is the thermal argument. The models I've looked at by people like McDonald and who was the other, Connell, that crew, so that if you heated that, the moon up above the melting point, that's significant, throughout significant portions of it, it would still remain hot today. Yeah, Jerry, you were shaking your head a bit there.
It's not really, you know, quite a correct argument. The zeroth order argument for getting a lot of arithmetic is something, in fact, that's the most embarrassing thing of the whole meeting. And it was really embarrassing from Apollo 11. We don't really understand it. The moon, with very precise measurements, looks as if it has a mean density very close to the rocks which are on the surface. Now then, if they were inside, they would have a much higher density, which means that doesn't work out too well, so it's layered. On the other hand, the moment of inertia of the moon, the resistance to spinning that the moon has, is almost perfectly the moment of inertia of a homogeneous sphere. So one of the problems about making a core is that you may make a core, but you have to do it subject to the constraint that it's not too big so that it does not goof up the moment of inertia, and even more sensitively, to ruin the mean density. And then there are heat transport problems are also can be put, but our problem is the simplest mechanical properties are an embarrassment to us.
I'd like to make two comments. One is that if in fact we started with the density of the basalt, and if the whole moon were made of basalt, then you are embarrassed. But luckily, most of the moon is not filled by basalt in Mare basins. Most of it is uplands, and I think from the analyses of the little chips, which is why I think they're so important, that means that that is much less dense. Most of the surface of the moon is much less dense than the samples that we're measuring in the Mare basins. The Mare basins give us a false lead because they only cover, let's say, less than 10% of the whole moon. So I'm not embarrassed by the fact that the moon is too heavy. I don't think it is. I think it's exactly the right density. Right. Yes. Well, then, as a matter of fact, the moon is not a perfect sphere. The moon has, and I think everyone that has worked with the dynamics admits that if you have a core below a certain size, that the measurements that we have so far would not reveal that core. So a core is entirely allowable. It's not an embarrassment. If there's a core there, it can fit into the dynamic models.
Again, we've realized in this
this conference, though, I think most people had stopped talking about cores because of the concern with the moment and and the strength and all these kind of things that sort of indicated that maybe the inside was cold. But all of the evidence presented here for the paleomagnetic field said that you had, or that you probably had to have, something like the mechanism that we have in the Earth. In other words, maybe a metallic core of some kind, giving a high magnetic field sometime in the past.
That's an enormously important observation. I think that was a very exciting statement. It really says something very fundamental about what has happened to the moon in the past. I want to make one other comment about the transportation processes, because a lot of people have worked very hard on transportation processes on planets like the moon. And I think we understand a great deal about those. One says that you distribute things by ejection from impact craters. And if that mechanism works, you can predict the distribution of the rocks. That is, the surface stuff goes far out and the deep stuff stays close in. And now we've had a couple chances to try it, and it seems to work. In the next two Apollo landings, that's one of the main things that will be addressed. We're going to get some stuff from the Imbrium Basin. This is the biggest impact crater we're ever going to have a chance to see on the moon. We're going to collect from the edge, and then on Apollo 15, we're going to collect from much farther in. If we're lucky, we'll see stuff that ranges from surface crustal material down to a depth of 50 miles. See, there are two ways to get it. One is from the volcanoes. The other is from very big impact basins. And that's the thing we're going to try in these next two missions. I mean, among other things. One other mechanism that operates, and I think the seismic stuff tells us that, and that's very exciting, that is that the moon is seismically active, not completely dead. One of the things that happens is it gets hit by other objects, and every time it gets hit, it gets shaken, so things migrate downhill. In addition, there seem to be some other mechanism of generating seismic signals, and this is the business that you've heard Latham talk about so many times. I think the important thing is that there are lots and lots of seismic events. Each of those seismic events shakes the surface, and there's seismic transportation of materials downslope. And we can see that in the fillets that are on the uphill side versus the downhill side. If it were all ballistic, that wouldn't be the case. There's got to be a downslope migration. The only place we disagree with Tommy is we don't think electrostatic things have anything to do with it. Now, I shouldn't say anything. They're a minor effect compared with the seismic shaking and the ballistic transport by impact.
Okay, we've been going on now for a little over an hour. I'd like, if we could, to stop at this point, and if you've got any questions to take up, perhaps some of the gentlemen can stay and talk for a minute.